Hello, everybody. It's time to find your seats, and you know what? So, my name's Catherine Inman, and I'm going to be your moderator this afternoon. I'm giving the stink eye to the people talking in the back. Thank you, guys. This session is going to be about community and salmon habitat conservation. I like that this morning it was said very well that salmon-based communities are important. Without the salmon, we don't have the communities. And I'm kind of thinking about, as I'm looking through the upcoming presentations, this block's going to be the converse. Without the community's participation, we don't have the salmon. It's kind of a circle. So I will be delighted to introduce our first speaker, Amy O'Connor from the Alaska Center. And she's going to be talking on salmon advocacy in Alaska, value-based public engagement, how action-based on science that supports the values are so very important. Come on up.
So my name is Amy O'Connor, and I'm an organizer with the Alaska Center. We were formerly known as Alaska Center for the Environment and Alaska Conservation Voters. If folks in the room are thinking, who are you guys? We haven't heard that name before. So we're the same group, same staff, same work. We just kind of converged our names back in July. So if you hear the Alaska Center, kind of a shout out to who we were before. But I work in Palmer and the Mat-Su. I'm the only staff person out in the valley, and it's been really fun to work in this community and get to know people and how much salmon means to all of them. So as we're all getting back from lunch, I'd like to kind of get a little bit more interactive here and see how many of you in this room have taken some sort of action to show that you value salmon. So how about a show of hands for folks in the last 2 years who've taken some sort of action? Ooh, that's almost everybody. All right, what about in the last 1 year? Okay, about the last 6 months? Sweet. All right, last 3 months. Cool. Okay, you guys are not falling into the trend that I was preaching. All right, what about the last, like, we'll say 2 weeks? Okay. Post-elections, how many people have taken a salmon action? All right. So as we see over time, in the past 10 years in Alaska, we've had some really big projects and threats to salmon statewide. And even though we don't have some of those same things of the same magnitude right now, there are still salmon issues that affect our smaller communities. And the reason that people take an action usually isn't because of a fact. It's because of how they feel. So for all you guys that did raise your hands, how many of you were spurred to take that action because it resonated with you? You felt something. You were angry, upset, afraid, worried about the salmon. Yeah, I sure know I was. That's why. Cool. All right. So what we've learned in the Alaska Center over the years is that science and research aren't enough on their own to spur people to action or enough to influence decision makers on their own. And it's really our job as an advocacy organization that we need to provide pressure on our decision makers to support the salmon habitat. And the only way to do that effectively is to do that by showing how the science and research, how that supports the values that Alaskans have around salmon. I just lost my cursor. So honestly, when it comes to politics, one thing that we realized is that facts really don't matter. It's not what our legislators listen to. Case in point, a week and a half ago. But facts are really important, but it's how those facts are presented. And when facts are turned into feelings and numbers of people, that's what creates change and response with our decision makers. So if you hand somebody a report that talks about parts per million, they're going to read it and say, okay. Versus if you hand them, a stack of 20,000 postcards or a petition with 40,000 names on it, when people are reacting to what that parts per million means to them and their communities, that's what's going to inspire them to listen and make some changes. So when we talk about how do we create this big group of salmon advocates, what we really need to focus on are our values. And value has a lot of definitions, one of them being the economic definition, but for this purpose, really focusing on values is what do salmon mean to us? How useful are they to us? What do they mean? Like, what memory, what feeling does this really evoke? So a value is something that we all can share. We all have personal values, but we also have community values. And I kind of take the stance that if we view Alaska as an entire community, whether you're a commercial fisherman in Bristol Bay or a sport fisherman in the Mat-Su, you care about salmon. How you relate to them might be different, but at the end of the day, like, you value salmon and you value what they mean to you. You know, in the Mat-Su, we've talked about this earlier, that the Mat-Su is growing. Our use of salmon in the valley is growing. And with that comes an increase in value that salmon economically mean a lot to us here. I think last year the average price per barrel of oil was like $35, but the average price for a king salmon was $75. So we look at that from a value-based approach in terms of money, and salmon definitely have more of a value that way. So how do we get people to go from science to advocacy? So when our values are threatened, so a threat to our value is going to inspire people to use the resources or the tools that they have into a power that they need to create the change that they want. So really the key takeaway here is that if we look at these five kind of different components, this is how we go from science to getting changes and getting our decision makers to listen to what salmon mean. Where the Alaska Center really comes in is that we can help provide the resources or the tools that go from science to action. And this has been really effective. So I was trying to quantify how strong are our salmon values. I mean, how do we really measure that? And there's no way you can ever measure a feeling or a worth to somebody on a personal level. But over the last 10 years, and this is just with the Alaska Center, not with our campaign partners and a lot of the major campaigns that we've worked on, we've had about 21,000 salmon supporters in the last 10 years. This number is actually really low. We went to a new data management system about 2.5 years ago. And since that new system, actually 18,000 of those were in the last 2.5 years. So I think in the last 10 years, our number is a lot higher. We just weren't tracking it the same way. In the last 18 months alone, we've had a little bit over 12,000 activists. So these aren't people that just click, you know, we like you on Facebook, or, you know, we sign a petition. These are folks that actually do a little bit more than that. So they'll sign a petition and they'll come to an event. They'll write a letter to the editor. They'll write, you know, an opinion piece in the newspaper. So this is people who are taking extra time to show that they value salmon. And the most important number up here is really we've had, this year so far, we've had just shy of 400 volunteers. And the volunteers are folks that value salmon so much that they're inspiring and encouraging others around them to act on those same values. They're the folks in your community that are knocking on your door saying, hey, you know, this riparian buffer ordinance is happening in the valley, and this is really important for us, and we need to get behind this. They're the folks that are saying, hey, I heard that there's going to be a showing of super salmon at the community, you know, at the depot. You should really come with me. Let's go. So these are the folks that are kind of going above and beyond, and these values resonate so strongly with them. In the Mat-Su, in about the last year, we've had 811 activists, and this is, again, just through the Alaska Center, that have taken some sort of action on Valley-specific issues. So specific threats to Valley in the Mat-Su, in 1 year alone, we've had 111 people. That's a really huge number. I mean, that's a little bit less than 1% of our Valley population, but so much of our population is sort of transient. They're not here for very long as people kind of move in and out. So we're hoping to increase that number. Our goal is actually for 2017 to have 1,500 folks in the Valley. So how exactly do we get people to learn about the science and a value-based approach? One of the things that happened this year was the first ever Alaska Wild Salmon Day was designated in August, and we had lots of different groups that did events all over the state. And there's a little video of one that happened in Anchorage. And as you guys are watching this, I want you to kind of pay attention to the people that are there, the activities that they're engaged in, and just how it covers every age from, you know, the youngest child to, you know, the multi-generational families. And you can just see in the people that salmon are important to them and they value them. And this is the opportunity to advocate for the salmon, to share the science, to use the values that people have all coming together and give them the specific details on why they need to act and act now. Sound? Maybe we'll pop it. Getting it? All right, let's try this one more time. There we go. Only in Alaska do we have a bucking salmon, right? Example of what salmon values do to bring people together, and I think at that event there were just about 700 people there, and that was only one in Anchorage. So what I'd like to leave you guys with is we make it really easy for folks to take action. It should be something that's easy and not a daunting task. So instead of putting your phones away, I would ask you all to take them out and take a second to protect what you value. So you can just text SALMON to 877-877, and this will set you up to go right to our legislators and decision makers saying that, hey, I value salmon, and I think that you guys should do something and listen to us and protect them. Thanks.
All right, I think we have a little time for a couple of questions. Anyone? Have we all sent that text now? Right.
How does a person become one of those 1,500 people you're looking for to be an activist with your organization?
Really easy. So the first step is to, once you text this number, actually entered kind of in our, like, I would say mailing list, but in our system, and then we can give you guys a call, and that will get you on the list to be invited to events. And then anybody that wants to get more involved, wants to do more, wants to take the next step, you can email me, call me, go on our webpage. If we have people that want to act and want to do more, we will help you do more. We will help you talk to your legislators. With the Alaska Center, we do have a political arm as well. We are a 501c4 organization, so we do have that tool as well that some of the other truly just advocacy-based organizations don't have.
We still have about 2 minutes for questions.
Yeah, my name's Arnie Thompson. I was impressed with the campaign involvement of Alaska Center in the recent campaigns. I don't know if you're in a position to comment on that, but I understand you had some pretty good successes in the campaign, and also that you're heavily involved in the Title 16 issue with Board of Fish and the Alaska Legislature. I don't know if you want to comment on that either, but I think people might want to know you're involved in it.
Yeah, so I guess I'll start by speaking specifically to the MATSU. Over the last year, we've been pretty heavily involved in partnering with the Susitna River Coalition to work opposing the Susitna Dam. On a borough level, we've been doing some work to support the riparian buffer ordinance. And then for the Title 16, we've been working to go to advisory council meetings, contact local business owners, citizens, to write in some letters of support. And then also just doing quite a bit of educating, so again, making that connection of the science and what's in the Constitution and what that says versus how that really impacts people on a daily basis or over the summer when they're going out fishing, what that means for them in 1 year, 5 years, 10 years from now.
I think you answered it. My question was going to be, in 2017, like, what is your sort of 1, 2, and 3 priorities for engaging people? It sounds like the buffer ordinance is among them.
Yeah, in the MATSU, so we are a statewide organization, so our goals are really framed on a statewide level. We did a lot of work with these elections with supporting candidates, conservation-friendly candidates, into the state Senate and state House. So kind of phase one of our goals is to be really working with them and reminding them that, hey, 20,000 people value salmon. And when they don't listen, you know, being able to deliver those 20,000 postcards on their desk and say, you should really read through all 20,000 of these comments because people are speaking from the heart, and it's pretty powerful. So that's kind of the priority, is making sure that our decision makers are listening to the collective voices in Alaska.
And now I'm going to introduce our next speaker, Ryan Viola, giving us some ideas for engaging people in salmon conservation ideas for the classroom. And looking at his abstract, I would add, and beyond. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what some of his ideas are. Coming up, Ryan.
Alrighty, so again, my name is Ryan Viola, and my presentation is salmon conservation ideas that we can use in the classroom. So before I start right here, I just want to talk a little bit about me. I have a Bachelor of Science degree in General Biology and a minor in General Chemistry that I got from the University of Minnesota Duluth in 2006. I also have a Bachelor of Science degree in Life Science Education that I got from Minnesota State University Moorhead in 2012. My first career job, I worked for a company called the Institute for Environmental Assessment. As an environmental technician, my main job duties were collecting and analyzing asbestos air samples and bulk samples for schools and hospitals. And I did that from 2006 to 2010. I am a licensed scuba diver. And I was a volunteer docent at the Minnesota Zoo from 2007 to 2011. And I put in about 1,200 hours of docent time during that period. And so I have a couple pictures right here. These are kind of some throwback pictures. The bottom picture explains what I do today, why I'm here in Alaska. And I am a licensed teacher. And right now I'm a substitute teacher in the MATSU Borough School District. All right, so another thing right before I start my presentation. This is a video that I shot with my underwater camera this summer here in August. It was right after my wedding. And this is Cottonwood Creek, and this is kind of right over behind my house where my wife and I live. And the water there is pretty clear, so I could see the salmon. So it wasn't like a huge surprise that I could see salmon in there. But I thought it was pretty neat because it was the first time I took my underwater case for my cell phone that I used for scuba diving. And I took it out in the river, and I just kind of wanted to see what was going on. And I thought it was really cool what's going to happen right up here. And basically, the salmon, these are pink salmon, got used to my presence in the camera, and they swam really close by. And I thought that was really interesting, really cool to have happen. So, all right, so today, so here it is. So three ways to inspire is basically my subject that I had today. So the kid above in front there is probably someone who lives in your classroom if you're a teacher. As a middle school science teacher, I know that these kids do exist and that in this day of age, the numbers of these students are more common, okay? Obviously, with things like technology and stuff like that, books don't really have a huge, can't really motivate the kids. So three ways to inspire, age level and subject do not matter. Now, I want to make this really clear before I start off. I think that the state of Alaska and other organizations do a fantastic job in the schools with the salmon life cycle and stuff. So this is not a sort of replacement for it. This is more of, as a regular teacher, you can't always have the Department of Fish and Game come in and do an activity with your students, okay? So it's what can you yourself do in the classroom, okay? So let's see here. So I have on there first two, I'll talk about picking up your pet's droppings. Second one, reduce, reuse, recycle. That's more of an environmental thing I'm talking about. And third one is creating excitement for the great outdoors. So picking up your pet droppings. Now, I should throw this out here that the idea of this came about because I've noticed I've been in Alaska for 3 years now, and I've been in the Matsu Valley for two of them. And everything in Alaska compared to my home state of Minnesota is fantastically better. Except for one little thing that kind of really ekes me, and it's the fact that, you know, especially now, after work, I take my dog out for a walk, and it's like going through a minefield. It really is. It's disgusting. And, you know, and I've overheard different people say that, you know, it's really no different than, you know, the moose or the caribou and stuff like that, and I kind of scratch my head a little bit, and I wonder about that. So, but anywho, how does all this stuff that I'm talking about today, how does this relate to the classroom? How can you do this, okay? And so these are ideas right here, you know, to create discussions. Research projects, the kid can do research projects on computers and stuff like that. There's online lab sessions. I know a lot about online lab sessions because my first couple of years of teaching, I was in schools, especially in Minnesota, that did not have a lot of money. So my science budget was next to nothing. So I really had to really depend upon online labs to do labs as a science teacher. These things, they can be reports, okay? Last, they have on their website articles, okay? It's kind of fun right there to have kids, you know, use technology and create a website with information that they find. So, like, on this one right here. So, as I was saying, many people have told me that it doesn't matter, okay? It's no different than the bear or the moose, okay? Now, my day job is a middle school science teacher. I'm not a lab technician that analyzes these type of things. So, these are things that I've just found pretty much just on, like, .org websites, okay? So, legitimate websites, okay? So, I just went ahead and just did a quick analysis of domesticated feces. I use feces, droppings, and scat interchangeably. That all means poop, so. So what I found is that obviously it's always different, obviously size of the animal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I guess the common bottom line is that in your domesticated feces, okay, so your dog, okay, the nutrient level is not really high in their feces, okay? And as a result of that, it has extremely high and toxic levels of viruses, bacteria, fungi, different parasites, okay, so things like Salmonella and E. coli. Okay, and then I went ahead and did analysis of wild scat, so like the bear, the moose, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, and comparing it to the feces of your cats, or not cats, dogs and stuff like that, the nutrient level is actually relatively high. You're talking about nitrogen, phosphorus, water content, et cetera, et cetera. As a result, it has kind of lower toxic levels of viruses, bacteria, and fungi. So, you know, in classes right here, I always get the students to say, okay, so what would you rather have, I ask them. Okay, would you rather have these domesticated feces, these things that have extremely high toxic levels of bacteria, do you want them flowing into your creeks that have baby salmon? Or would you rather have things like your bear stuff kind of flowing into streams that have much lower levels of viruses and bacteria? And that right there is enough to spur a discussion right there. Second thing that I'm talking about right here is reduce, reuse, recycle. Okay. Now, I'm not talking about reduce, reuse, and recycle because we have a lesson on that, and that can be done anywhere, and this is not just for science, okay? Now, the books that I have pictured on there, I'm not saying that these exact books whatsoever, okay? But these books are really long, okay? And I own these books, and I love to read books. What I've done is I just scan specific chapters of these books, and these chapters are short, and it relates to exactly what we're talking about, okay? So even in English classes right here, okay, this could be just a great homework assignment, just scanning. So, like, one of the things I have on here, the Recycler's Handbook, okay? That's a book that I found at a thrift store about 5 years ago in Minnesota, and I bought it because it was about a nickel, and I scanned a bunch of chapters out of there because it was right before Earth Day, and it was a great resource for Earth Day, okay? Next book I have on there is Silent Spring by Rachel Carson. If you haven't heard of that book, I suggest you probably read it. It's not specifically on salmon, but it's basically the book that started the entire environmental movement back in the 1950s. It's a very powerful book. And I scanned the first chapter out of there. And, you know, English teachers can definitely use that. It's a great resource. Next one I have in there, Omnivore's Dilemma. Okay, it's a great book. Obviously, they can't read the whole thing, but scanning, like, maybe even a paragraph or two, okay, and using that in elementary schools, okay, and explain to the kids that, yeah, there is a difference between having McDonald's for dinner with the Happy Meal toy versus having sockeye salmon, okay? Next one on there, See Around Us Again, Rachel Carson book, and it's a really good history type of book that can definitely be used by history teachers. Last book I have in here, I put it in red. It's King of Fish. I can't really say too much more about that. I've scanned about 8 chapters out of that book. If they ever do have time, I would suggest you might, like an AP English class, read the entire book. So, last thing I have is a movie I use as my kind of go-to if I'm like puking sick and I can't lesson plan. And so for the sub right there, okay, because it's really easy to find. It's a good video resource. It's Ryan the Gauntlet. And it's a PBS Nova special. And it's easy to find on YouTube, or you can find it on pbs.org. And that right there, any subject whatsoever, and the students can just write down a few things that about salmon, questions that they have about the movie, comments, okay? Last thing is excitement for the great outdoors. Now, this is a video that I shot this summer when my family came up here. So my dad's in front there. He's in the green jacket. That's my nephew right behind there. And then me, you can't see me in front. I'm fishing. So you can see my dad. He's got a pretty good smile on his face. And you can't see my nephew. He's got a smile on his face. And, of course, you can't see me. I have a smile on my face. We're all having a fantastic time. Okay? And the whole point is that creating excitement for the great outdoors. As a teacher, I know that, quite frankly, we do good things to start off school, start off each class. And I love it as a teacher, getting the good things from students that talk about, hey, you know, I went fishing this weekend, or I'm going fishing tonight, or going hiking, any of these good things, okay? And I could talk all day and night, but quite frankly, and being at the Minnesota Zoo for so long, this is one of my favorite quotes that I had in my classroom, okay? Teaching a child not to step on a caterpillar is as valuable to the child as it is to the caterpillar by Bradley Miller. I truly feel that unless you create good excitement as a teacher to your students, to a parent, to your kids, you can't make that point right there, okay? The fact that I'm up here doing this today, and I'm very strongly believe that everyone in here had great experiences growing up with hunting and fishing, okay? And right there. You can't get that point across without great experiences. So, anyways, my time's up here, so I do have time right here if anyone has any questions. I put down my resources and pictures. Most of them are mine, but I wanted to put the ones on there that aren't mine.
All right, well, we have just a couple minutes left for questions. No? Yes, sir. Or were you just stretching? No. Okay. Excellent.
If there are any scientists in the audience that would like to volunteer or work with teachers in the MATSU, what's the best place to contact?
What I do, basically, contacting principals of these different schools, emailing district offices, getting a hold of them, because that's a trickle-down effect that will get to the specific teachers like myself. If you know specific teachers, actually talking to them directly can save a lot of time to get to it.
And I'll jump in as well. I offer a lot of education programs. And one very good way is to contact the district office if you don't have a network or personally know some teachers. So Catherine Essery, CATHERINE, .ESSARY at matsuk12.us. She can send an instant email or add into her weekly newsletter what you can offer if you have a program or something that you want to get out to teachers. We have about 1,200 of them in Matsu District. All right, well, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Well, continuing on our theme of connecting people with the natural world, next up we have Sam Snyder, who's with Trout Unlimited, and he's going to talk on engaging Alaskan anglers in conservation and science. So we'll learn some more about local efforts and opportunities and some exciting pilot projects.
Is everybody still awake? Excellent. So this actually makes a good follow-up to Amy's presentation. So if Alaska Center is looking at engaging Alaskan values broadly around salmon, I think one of the things that we at Trout Unlimited are trying to do is focus in on engaging, educating, and mobilize the sportsman community a little bit more effectively. So and in doing that, tapping into obviously those values. A little bit of history or trivia for you, just to kind of start off the conversation. It's been said that no sport is more written about than fishing, and that might be true. I'm not sure I've actually seen any quantitative analysis of it, but I do know that the fifth edition of Isaac Walton's The Complete Angler, the one that has fly fishing in it, is the third most printed text in the English language. So that in of itself speaks to the importance of fishing, particularly in the Western imagination. And for centuries, anglers, and particularly fly fishers, but anglers in general, have been writing about the value of fishing, the value of fishing to connect us to the outdoors, the value of fishing to connect us to community, fishing as a religious experience, as a spiritual exercise. And then that sort of expression of a value of a sport has often led to a increased engagement in conservation. I think when we look at the history of conservation in the United States and in North America, anglers in the sportsman community have historically played a very vital role in the conservation movement, public lands preservation, and obviously engaging in response to large projects, which we'll get into here in a second. Though I think more recently I'll talk about this a little bit, but more recently I'm troubled by the fact that sportsmen in general tend to vote against their interests, see last week as exhibit number one. But Trout Unlimited comes out of this history of sportsman-based conservation. Trout Unlimited, I'm sure you all know, but just as a quick history, is about a little over 50 years old, born on the banks of the Ossawa River in Michigan. looking at brown trout restoration there. Ironically, they weren't talking about grayling restoration. But today, our mission is to conserve, protect, and restore North America's fisheries. We have about 150,000 members, about 300 staff working across the country to conserve, protect, and restore. I think it's been mentioned a couple times today that, you know, in Alaska, we're lucky. We don't necessarily have to restore. Obviously, there are issues in the more populated areas, culvert restorations, but we don't have to do the type of restoration, the type of triage, pouring money into protecting small vestiges of Rio Grande cutthroat trout, for example, like we do in the lower 48. So we have a lot of opportunity to do the protecting and the conserving, and that's where we focused a lot of our attention. Now in Alaska, we focused, Trout Unlimited has worked very differently than our national model, which our national model is historically very volunteer-driven and often focusing on volunteers concerned with their sort of local backyards. We've gotten involved in bigger issues in recent times. But in Alaska, we've been working for about a decade, heavy involvement in the fight against the proposed pebble mine and the Tongass National Forest. There's some restoration work there. Also engaging in the recent Tongass land management plan revision, heavily involved in the new threats proposed by the transboundary mines, which have come up a couple times. And then over the past couple of years, we've also worked very heavily and closely with the Susitna River Coalition on the fight against the proposed Susitna Dam. And now going forward, one of the top conversations, we've been involved in these projects, are fighting these large projects, but now we're looking at those big policy questions, those big policy changes. How do we get to the root of the issue facing these projects and our waters? And that's this Title 16 conversation. So we're very much involved in that effort as well as a policy issue. But I also want to talk about kind of what we're actually, Trout Unlimited, is trying to get back to a little bit of its basics. How do we build a stronger community of sportsmen? Rather than focusing on these single issues, the pebbles, the Susitnas, the transboundary mines. And in the past couple of years, we've had a staff member who's been working to really rehabilitate or build chapters and focus on building a community based on volunteers. And so we have about 1,000 dues-paying members in Alaska for Trout Unlimited and many more that are supportive of our work. And through our chapters, just the South Central chapter based out of Anchorage, but is hoping to do more work in the Mat-Su, we've got about 577 volunteer hours just in the past year, about 259 of that's direct conservation work. That's stream cleanups, that's engaging in stream bank restorations in, say, Matanuska Lake, also engaging with the collaborative effort around the removal of the Eklutna Dam. And so, and then the other part of that, the other half of that, volunteer hours, environmental education, working with the schools, fly tying, fisheries education in schools. And so I think we're hoping that that's just the beginning of what will be a stronger growing opportunity. And again, the Mat-Su is a place that we're hoping to have a stronger volunteer base, have events up here, talk about what the interests and the concerns are of people in this community, as well as, say, Anchorage or the Kenai, for example. But organizing, as Amy noted, Alaskans get involved in as activists on different levels for different reasons, but I think we have a real opportunity to organize sportsmen in specifically. Sportsmen might get involved in the TU chapter. They might just want a fly fishing club to start, but then they get involved in different ways. But Trout Unlimited, through our work with all of these bigger campaigns and collaborations, have some, you know, 100,000 people in our broader universe. And these are people that we can talk to by email. These are people that we can activate for, to take action on certain things, to call their legislators. About 70,000 of them are registered Alaskan voters. These are people that can call their legislators. These are people that we can mobilize to vote in elections. And, you know, these people are involved because they care about salmon, because they consume salmon, and because a lot of them are fishermen. And anglers of varying sorts. They're personal use fishermen, they're sport fishermen, some of them are commercial fishermen. But I think as we look at the landscape, how do we more aggressively even, maybe that's the word, engage in the sportsman community. Because if we look just at a recent ADF&G survey, there are about 450,000 of Alaskan residents regularly participate in Alaska sport fisheries. That's a huge number. Now, a lot of people, that might just be one time a year. So I'm actually curious how ADF&G came up with that number, but that's a huge number of people that are recreating on our rivers and therefore have some experience and develop those values for those places, for those fish. If we could get 1% of those people on a regular basis to speak up, to become vocal advocates, to call their legislators when they think something is, something is amiss, when there's an HB 77 on the table or Pebble has another permit that they're applying for, the Susitna Dam is back on the table. These are people that we can motivate and drive, and advocates do matter. Maybe it's trickier for scientists to be advocates, but I don't think you necessarily lose credibility by being an advocate. It's how you do it, and it's a partnership between scientists, between the research community. How do we better tell your stories? Because, parts per million makes people glaze over. But if we can tell that story to those people, how it impacts fishing in their backyards, then hopefully we can engage them and motivate them toward stronger action. Obviously, in the MATSU, I think the MATSU is this is the litmus test for us. This is where population and salmon habitat are most have collided. This is where we have the fragmented population or the most direct threats of fragmented population, unlike, say, Bristol Bay, where you have the intact portfolio. This is also where we have the people. This is where we have a voter base that we can engage. And these are people that admittedly voted perhaps against salmon interests in certain ways in the past election. So how do we educate? How do we outreach to them? How do we educate them? How do we motivate them to take action? Because ultimately, salmon can't vote, but we can. And if we can meet them on the streams and hear their stories and help them figure out how to tell their stories, then I think we have a better future and more opportunities for salmon in Alaska. Because now more than ever, the local voices matter, the boroughs matter, the municipal elections, the state elections. Those are the things that are going to be absolutely critical as we look at issues facing EPA, federal agencies who also have management responsibilities in the state of Alaska. So.
Thank you very much, and we have about 3 minutes for some questions. I saw the one in the back first, next to you.
Hi, this might be a question for you and Amy, but one of the things that I've noticed when you kind of look at the landscape of all the different organizations that are trying to do the education and the motivation and the kind of call to actions, it can be you as an individual, very few of us, I would imagine, could become members and donate and actively participate in all those organizations.
Right.
So what, since we can't do that as individuals, what is it that organizations are doing to figure out like how to work together kind of in a more collaborative impact or community impact model so that there's like a thing or a place or a group that we can go to, donate to, volunteer for, and know that that's kind of going towards the general overall energy rather than having to be like, well, you know, can't give to Trout Unlimited
right.
this year, so I can, you know, that kind of a thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I'm not entirely sure how to answer it or that we've figured out how to help you answer that. I will say, though, that I think, so just as a little bit of history on how all these campaigns have worked, historically we had like the Pebble campaign, and we had the campaign against the Chewitna mine, and we had Susitna, and everybody was in their own little silos. And I worked on Pebble but I used to say, well, I'm not going to talk with that campaign because, you know, we have to keep our distance, and I can't talk about Chewitna because I'm only against this mine. And we had these sort of these interesting and maybe false silos. I think based on a resource need, based on just it's a small community, I think you're seeing an increasing collaboration of organizations. So Trout Unlimited working with the Alaska Center, working with the Susitna River Coalition, working with commercial fishermen for Bristol Bay. I think you're seeing that we're starting to share resources, we're sharing tools, we're being more collaborative in our messaging. Now, that doesn't help you answer, like, who's the one organization that I should give to? But I think that because the landscape is so small and because the threats are so big, you're seeing a reality where we're starting to collaborate more. So maybe if you had an affinity, maybe if you're of an avid angler and you said, well, maybe you give to Trout Unlimited. Maybe you are interested in just more sort of broad salmon conservation. So and climate change too. So maybe you want to think about Alaska Center. So maybe you're still choosing based on a particular affinity, but I think that we're seeing a reality where those donations are being leveraged more effectively through the collective effort. And so even if you give to one, it helps the broader. It's not a great answer, and that's something we need to think about, how we tell that to you all, but that's kind of, I guess, the short answer.
We have time for one more.
So I guess the question I have is, I heard you refer several times to the Mat-Su in a recent election. Mat-Su voted against salmon. I didn't see anything on the election asking if I wanted to get rid of salmon and if I would vote against them. And so I guess I would say, what in the world are you talking about?
Yeah, you got me there. I mean, I guess I was focusing a bit on the Mat-Su because we're in the Mat-Su. But I think if we maybe Alaskans cast their vote in the national election in a way that puts our salmon in jeopardy, I think that would have been the more honest and probably appropriate. So were salmon on the ballot this year? No. But were elected officials who don't believe in science, don't believe in climate change, want to gut the regulatory authority of the agencies that help us protect those salmon, were they on the ballot? Yes. And so I shouldn't have singled out the Mat-Su. I think in the context of, I was trying to situate in the context, so I'm not blaming anybody, but I think Alaska as a whole, if we value salmon, we have to take the steps, and this is our job as organizers, to better educate people so that they understand that votes for people in power influence how our agencies can manage salmon, can help us protect salmon, and things like that for the long term for community. I don't know if that helps.
Thank you very much.
Next, I'm excited to hear from Tracy Smith with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And she's going to talk about the Mat-Su Valley Stream Bank Rehabilitation and Habitat Protection Cost Share Program, lending a hand in the community to help salmon habitat. It's an incentive program with partners to sustain and enhance habitat for fish.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. As Catherine said, my name is Tracy Smith. I am a habitat biologist for the Department of Fish and Game, but I don't work for the Division of Habitat. I work for the Division of Sportfish RTS, and RTS stands for Research and Technical Services. So, what is the cost share program? Who here has ever heard of the cost share program? Show of hands. Okay, so quite a few of you. Today I'm going to enlighten all of you about what we are, and what we do, and what we try to protect. And as you all know, we're out here for one goal, the little guy, right? The salmon fry. That's my boss. So what is the cost share program? Well, it is administered jointly between the Department of Fish and Game and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and we partner with so many different entities at a statewide level that I didn't put all their logos on the slide because I didn't want to leave anybody out. We provide project funding for on-the-ground projects, be rehabilitation. We provide technical support. We also supply
on the ground overseeing of a project, and we work with landowners and land managers to fix salmon habitat throughout the state of Alaska. We've had projects in Southeast, Kenai Peninsula, Matsu Valley, Fairbanks. So the only places we haven't really gotten is getting out west into Bristol Bay. And hopefully, if things go well, you may not have to. Through our program, we started in 1995 on the Kenai Peninsula, and in 2008, we made our way up to the Matsu Valley. So the program objectives of our program are, number one is to reestablish riparian function by removing structures that are detrimental to juvenile salmon. Things like riprap, sheet piling, gabions, cars, you name it, man-made tires. You'd be surprised the things we find. We want to conserve and sustain healthy nearshore habitat and riparian vegetation. We conserve by putting in either elevated light-penetrating walkways, root wads, cabled spruce trees, things like that that can protect if what existing is already there. We also rehabilitate and enhance human-impacted salmon habitat and riparian vegetation. I said it early in the NIFHAP round robin. We love our salmon, we love them to death, and in the process we love our salmon banks to death, and we get rid of all the vegetation, and that's what we're here to kind of counteract. And then we conduct stream bank rehabilitation workshops. The big thing is we want to educate and empower all people, whether they be land managers, landowners, DOT, DNR, DEC, anybody. We want to give them the tools to make sure that we are protecting our habitat, or if we are developing it, we are doing it wisely. So, rehabilitation projects attempt to replace human-impacted and eroding shorelines by simulating natural stream bank and native vegetation. This can be seen here on the right. This is an ideal area here in the Matsu Valley. Ideal meaning the vegetation looks good. This is on Cottonwood Creek. It's got an irregular structure, great habitat, overhanging vegetation. Good for fish. Rehabilitation projects also attempt to install woody debris that provides shelter for juvenile fish, gives them somewhere to hide, a substrate for a food source, pockets and eddies of optimal water velocities for juvenile salmon habitat. And this is a completed restoration project. This was done on Willow Creek. These are all root wads that stabilize the bank and at the same time provide instant gratification habitat for when the water comes up. We also try to install riparian vegetation to provide stability of the shoreline, provide shade from overhanging vegetation, terrestrial food sources, and reduce sediment from entering the water. This was another project here. This was on Willow Creek. We had a tributary going in, it was on Nancy Lake, where we had a tributary going into the lake where they had no vegetation and no cover. And the landowner kept putting rocks on it, thinking that that would solve the solution. To be in the wintertime, the rocks would be picked up by the ice and be carried out into the main channel or into the lake, which would be adding more sediment, which you don't want to do. Also, we want to minimize sediment introduction and eroding banks to prevent the smothering of coarse salmon and their incubating eggs and also aylwin. Critical things. So those are things we want to do. Do we think we have a lot of times to do it? Of course we do, because we have things like this. This is the constant struggle. We have the elusive houseboat, or soon to be in the river house. We have this. You can see a little bitty house back here. This is 19 dump truck loads of rock that they put on their entire shoreline because we thought that would combat erosion from happening. We have creative. We have what I call the dairy gabion effect, which is milk crates filled with rock and strewn together. And then we have good old-fashioned Detroit riprap. These are all, while maybe potentially effective and creative tools or techniques to restore or to stabilize a stream bank, to stabilize a stream bank, they do exist. And landowners are usually like, well, I didn't know. And that's usually it. They don't know the proper things to do. They don't know how to stabilize their bank to make it, number one, stable for the bank, but also to provide fish habitat. And that's where we and our partners, both U.S. Fish and Wildlife and Fish and Game, and then also our partners, come in, and we work with landowners to restore habitat and projects. So here in the Matsu Valley, I'm going to talk about a couple of the projects we've conducted in the last 3 years. Their first one was out here at McRoberts Creek. This is a heavy utilized and traffic area for ATVs. Very popular. This area here, they would turn into the creek and either go straight down the creek or up and around. And if you've ever been to this area, you'll see there's a lot of impact from ATVs. Because we Alaskans, we love to recreate. So We wanted to make sure that the ATV still had access, but we also wanted to make sure that our fish still were protected and had some, added some vegetation. So in 2014, we worked with a group of both landowners. We had a DNR, their land crew, come in of all their technicians. We all worked together, and we did this. And so this is about 2 months after it was installation. We installed 80 feet of core log, 30 feet of trench willows, 50 feet of brush layers, and then about 1,000 square feet of veg mat and protective fencing to guide the ATVs to a specific area so they weren't continuing to trample the bank. Another project. This is actually a third phase for the Big Lake area. Originally, they had their floating docks all the way up against this lovely shoreline. Can you guys see what's in there? It's like the dirty word for all habitat perimeters. It's the ever-dreaded gabion basket. So we also call them sediment time release capsules, because over time, as you hook the top, if you go back when they were pulling them out, they hook the top, and all of that rock and the contents just go right out into it. Did it stabilize the bank? Yes. Did the landowner think they were doing the best thing at the time when they installed it? Yes. But over time, of course, they all start to fall apart and decompose. So we went in 2005 and removed, it was 100 feet by 20 feet wide of rock and gabions, and 2,600 tires from that were buried in that bank behind it. So it was super stable. It wasn't going anywhere for a while, but it was pretty messy. So we installed 100 feet of root wads, and then also 100 feet of trench willows behind it, and then about 40,000 square feet of native veg mat seed mix, which is prescribed by our DNR partners at the Plant Materials Center, and we seeded the background of it. So it looks pretty good, and it was instant gratification. It was great. As soon as we removed the silt screen, we had juvenile fish coming in and utilizing the rootwad fans. Willow Creek. This is one of our restoration workshop sites. If you're familiar with the Nash Boulevard or Nash Road area, right up from here, you can kind of see it in the picture. If I hit the right button. Right here is where Nash Boulevard. If you've driven out there, the road where it used to be is about almost 40 feet over than what it used to be. And what happened is when the floods came up, the water came up, this landowner who had originally a 5-acre parcel now has about 3.25 acres. He actually has land on both sides of the waterway because it just came in and wiped them out. So we came in with a crew, and in one long day with 28 awesome volunteers, we made this happen. And so we put in 200 feet of cabled spruce trees, 100 feet of core log, 20 feet of brush layers, 80 feet of trench willows, and 2,000 square feet of veg mat and live staking. It was amazing, and it looks great today, and it withstanded the floods in 2015 after that. He had landowners both upstream and downstream home that both lost property, and his project worked great. He came in, he said, "I'm a believer. I'm your poster child." Then we had Nancy Lake. I talked about this briefly earlier. They put all these really large, expensive rocks on their property just to have the ice sheets come up, pick them up, and either push them up onto their land or pull them out into the lake. And so this was actually a month and a half after it was done. So it was just simple brush layers and veg mat. Then Meadow Creek, in 2014, they removed an old culvert and put in this beautiful new structure. And so we went in our 2016 workshop. We removed 250 feet of plastic netting straw wattle that were left over. And then we installed 110 feet of core log, 40 feet of brush layers, a ridiculous amount of trenched willows, about 8,000 square feet of native seed mix and fencing, and then also some educational signs. And it looks amazing. When within 48 hours after installing the projects, we had lamprey spawning in the gravel downstream section. And then going about a month and a half later, which is the picture, we had sockeye coming in as well. So this is looking at another portion of it as well. So we put in different structures just to keep ATVs from going in and out of the water there, and it's done quite well. So over the last eight years, because we started in 2008 here in the Matsu Valley, we have removed over 1,600 feet of detrimental structures. We've conserved almost 40,000 square feet of healthy nearshore fish habitat and riparian vegetation, and we have rehabilitated over 67,000 square feet of human-impacted riparian vegetation, and we've conducted 8 stream bank rehabilitation workshops, which we had 174 participants, And then we also reached out to about 380 landowners to talk about our program. So if you're interested, you can fill out one of our applications. It's pretty simple. The biggest thing I have to say, give me directions on how to get to your property. And here's a shameless plug for our 2017 Cost Share workshops coming up. We have them in Fairbanks, Soldotna, and the Matsu Valley, and also in the Anchorage. And just because this is so fantastic, and I don't know how to do this. Okay, we'll see if it works. This was actually why we do what we do. This is a RITWAD project. And you can see the juvenile fish utilizing the space just after it was put in. So
amazing. We have a couple minutes for questions. I see one in the back.
Not a question, but a comment for Tracy. I'm on the Marnie Thompson. I'm on the Matsu Partnership Steering Committee, and Tracy is the ADF&G representative on the steering committee. And it was just a couple of months ago that I found out the kind of work that she does, and so we were talking about projects and topics for the symposium, and then I asked her if she would be willing to do this presentation to create general awareness about what Fish and Game is doing. And, of course, we've already heard from her on the trout, Midwest and Western States Trout Partnership, so she's really a valuable asset for us out here in South Central Alaska.
Well, thank you very much.
Hi, Tracy. Thanks for the presentation. I was curious, do you ever sort of crosswalk your locations with, I know you mentioned you're not in a habitat division, but to look to see, are these places that were just never permitted, or they were permits that have sort of run south, you know, they've kind of gone a little sour, and maybe we could start looking at, well, what's the life expectancy of some of these projects that have gotten permits?
Oh, fantastic question. So some of the projects that we have addressed are actually, I get an application or I get a call from our Palmer Habitat office saying, hey, this is an application that came in. Would you be interested in working with this landowner or this land manager on a project? I think it would be a great fit for cost share. And so we get a lot of ones saying, or hey, do you want to maybe work with them and kind of guide them in the right direction to do a fish-friendly technique? So we do a lot of that. We partner with our habitat offices at a statewide level, just trying to make sure, saying, okay, if we're working with a private landowner. But then also, we have had projects that, oh, completely get derailed, and it was installed, or historically they're grandfathered in, so to speak. It was done so long ago that the landowner honestly had no idea what they thought was the best technique, and they thought, you know, rock will save us all. And so they'll spend thousands upon thousands of dollars installing these huge rock fortresses, which I call them, on their shorelines, and to have them all crumble, and then it's like dollar bills just floating away in the water. And so I always say, you know, everyone has played, you know, Rochambeau, rock, paper, scissors as a kid. Rock, paper, RITWAD. RITWADs will always win. Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you. And next up, we have Kim Solyan with the Great Land Trust. And she's going to talk about landscape scale conservation, caring for salmon as a shared community asset. So she'll be addressing educating community members along with many, many partners.
Got to bring some props up. So, I need to take a picture of you all, because if I don't take a picture, it didn't really happen. And I'm so surprised that there's so many of you still here. The last full presentation session of the afternoon. I know we have a great movie later and tidbits left, but thank you all for staying so long. I know we have really busy lives and lots of places to be, so it's an honor to be part of the Matsu Salmon Habitat Partnership. I've certainly felt the last day and a half listening to you all share your presentations, like, what a stellar group of humans we have in this community working really hard to support salmon. And I just want to say that your work really matters. And a lot of you, the work that Great Land Trust does, as most of you know, we're a nonprofit. Which way do I click? Oop, up. We're a nonprofit land trust, and we work to buy land for conservation. We also put conservation easements on property, really to support the lands and waters that provide for economic health and quality of life of all Alaskans. And a lot of our work is based on the research and foundational data that you all and your organizations are providing about where that quality habitat is and where we should direct our conservation efforts. So definitely, we appreciate your efforts. So today I'm going to give an update on some NFHAP funding that Great Land Trust was awarded in 2014 to work on two different projects, to share a little bit more about who we are as an organization and how we focus our efforts. Our work is really organized around these four pillars. I think living in Alaska and certainly in the Mat-Su borough is privilege. And a lot of that is those feelings are based on we get to live an exceptional quality of life and outdoor lifestyle because we have access to open space, because we have habitat for salmon and moose and can fill our freezers with those animals. And also our partnerships are really key to our efforts. We wouldn't be able to do it without everyone. Oh, if I just keep pushing the red button, nothing happens. I have to push the arrow. one more link to our shared values, and I'll apologize. I'm not my normal self. I got sick, and then I got food poisoning, and I am just kind of messy, so forgive me if I lose track of my details. But I think there probably isn't anyone in the room that wouldn't agree that, you know, doing work for salmon or open space or, you know, wildlife, conserving habitat, water quality is really part of who we are as people. It's about our shared values. And so how great for me to be able to work for an organization that's conserving the lands that are doing these functions. Maybe if I push a different button. There. So back to what I'm really going to talk about, and as the NFHAP funding we were awarded in 2014, we wrote for two proposals. One was to work on looking at the co-management of some lands. We held a... Oh, God, you guys, I'm sorry. Those of you who have seen me present before know that you normally am on it. Okay, so... our largest conservation easement is here. It's an easement we hold on lands owned by Aklutna Inc., the Native Corporation for Aklutna Native Village. And we closed on that conservation easement in 2012. And over the years, I'm going to stop using the pointer arrow, because that's what keeps getting me. Well, this is a fine slide. So over the years, as we've part of holding a conservation easement on a piece of property means that we're connected to that property in perpetuity. So conservation easements are written so they limit certain types of development, certain types of use, they limit subdivision, but they do allow for some things. So for this particular conservation easement, certainly this property was identified because, you know, it supports the confluence of these two rivers, it's linking the Chugach State Park to Pomeroy Hay Flats Refuge and the Kinnick Public Use Area, so it's creating this really big conservation corridor for wildlife and salmon and open space. What was my point? Sorry. So this area is also, in some ways, it's within the Matanuska River Corridor and the Kinnick River Corridor that it's considered by some as no man's land because it's just open space, it's probably just state land. Who cares what happens down there? Nobody's really paying attention. But it's also land that has complex set of ownership surrounding that area with the tribal corporation and lands managed by Fish and Game and DNR and Experimental Farm, Mental Health Trust. So there's all these different land managers having some responsibility and some say over how these lands can be used. And then, of course, the orange lands are the lands that are covered by our conservation easement. So there's also this matrix of trails that pretty much start up at the Old Glen Highway up here in Palmer at the Old Glen Bridge and go all the way down the Matanuska Corridor. And over the years, I think trails have been established, motorized use happens, the community has grown, and over time, someone's had lots of fun out there and it's damaged the habitat. So I'm just going to share a series of pictures. Most of these happened on Palmer Hay Flats refuge land, but not all of them. But so as we're thinking about as a land trust, how do we manage lands in perpetuity for conservation when things like this may be happening nearby or migrating over into those lands? And so I'm sure some of you have seen this before in the Matsu, if this, and oops, like who has the disposable income to drive their on-road vehicle down here and ruin it? I don't know. Creates issues like this, oops, like guess Rabbit Slough is not frozen yet. It's just shocking to me to see all of this. How do people find themselves in this situation? We decided, because a lot of those trails that I showed you in that other map, all those red lines on that piece of paper, funneled down to the lands that we hold a conservation easement on the Kinnick Islands. And so we're trying to figure out how do we prevent, those vehicles from crossing into that property, from taking salmon where they shouldn't, from poaching moose, camping, dumping, abandoning their cars. So we decided, let's have a meeting, or a few. And those NIFHAP funds paid for us to have a number of meetings with all the various land managers to talk about what can we do to help educate the community about the various land ownership in the Matanuska Corridor, and help them understand when you're out recreating, know whose land you're supposed to be on, or whose land you're on, what's allowed, where the permitted stream crossings are so you don't trample the baby salmon. And the result of those meetings, we end up producing a map that looks like this. I have a couple examples here. These actually took a long time. I think maybe a year for us to come to agreement on what's going to be on the map, how we're going to show the different land ownership. And then I think it took 3 years for, I won't name the company, to just print the signs. We were so confused. What is taking so long for them to print the signs? Anyway, got the signs made. Did lots of fun field work because he had to go out on the trails and figure out where are those trail intersections, where are some key areas that if we start putting up these signs, notifying recreational users, hikers, bikers, people on their four-wheelers, hunters, fisher people, letting them know you're here, this is the surrounding land, this is what's allowed in the refuge, this is actually a Kalutna land, and if you want to access their property, you need a permit. So did a little research, figured out where to put those signs. So this fall, Doug Hill, the refuge manager, shout out to Doug over there, it's awesome. He and his crew have put up about 15 of these signs at some of these major trail intersections, letting people know where they are, where they're going, and to make sure, they're not crossing over into this Kalutna conservation easement land. And these red dots here are going to be signs where the land trust is going to go in and put boundary signs along the conservation easement. I don't have an example of that. I forgot to bring one for you to see, but highlights this land has been conserved for habitat values, and if you want to access this property, please contact Kalutna Inc. So I'm pretty excited to see what's going to happen over the next year or so and see if we get any phone calls or people, letting us know they saw the signs and they appreciated it as being a recreational user. Now they're probably not going to get lost out there. Maybe they won't drive their Jeep into the wetlands. Anyway, so that's one project that those NIFHAP funds paid for, and I'd love to see us be able to continue this community education initiative, just like what are the basics we need to let people know so they can have good behavior, and putting signs up seems like a really great first step. Oh, here's some pictures of them putting the signs up.
So another project you all heard me talk about last year was our Baby Salmon Live Here campaign. Though this wasn't funded by the NIFHAP funding, the Salmon Habitat Partnership is certainly a partner on this project. So we got a permit from the Mat-Su Borough to put 30 Baby Salmon Live Here signs at key borough intersections. Oh my God, 1 minute. Intersections along priority water bodies for salmon. So we got about 19 up this fall. We hoped to get all 30 up, but our contractor, he spent half the time in the field putting up a sign, talking to all the neighbors who had to stop and say, what are you doing? What's going on? Well, I'm putting up these baby salmon live here signs. And then neighbors would be like, well, salmon don't live here. They don't come up this far. And so then it would turn into a longer conversation. So here's just a few pictures of some of the signs that were put up. One of them is at the site where salmon in the classroom happens down at Spring Creek. And this fall, about 400 or more fourth graders got to do their salmon sampling underneath the sign, so I thought that was pretty cool. The other thing that's been happening, Fish and Game actually asked Ron Benkert, I don't know if he's here, put up a number of these signs in the Moose Range, and I got calls all fall from hunters saying, I was in the Moose Range, look, hunting for moose, and I saw your signs, and I saw the habitat destruction. How can we help? Is there anything we can do? So I was like, whoa, they're working! That's very exciting. Okay, now I'll go fast through the next exciting conservation project that we're working on. I'm getting the stop, so I won't take questions, but I'll be here later. So we are in the process of purchasing about 300 acres adjacent to Settlers Bay Golf Course. A few years ago, we purchased a 1,000-acre in-holding within Palmer Hayflats Refuge and did a big public celebration campaign about the acquisition and what the project, you know, was going to, you know, protect habitat and allow for access. And the landowners came to me and said, I want to do that with my property. So we've spent the last 2 years getting to know the landowners, fundraising, working with our partners at the Mat-Su Borough. Hopefully they will take the donation of the land once we're able to purchase the property. And our dream is to create, now this is oriented a little, that's Kinnick Arm here, it's kind of side, and yeah, it's kind of hard to tell. So the golf course is here, out in Kinnick Fairview area. This is a mock drawing of the trails that we'd like to put in. Right now there's existing roads, this was going to be platted to be a subdivision, but the landowner decided I'd rather see it become a park. And if any of you know the Kinnick Fairview community, they don't have any upland parks in their neighborhood. I mean, they have the golf course, and they have Goose Bay, and they have Palmer Hayflats Refuge, but for the most part, if it's not frozen, it's hard to access and take your dog for a walk. So anyway, we're really looking forward to come out this year with that project and invite you all to participate, and we're having a party on December 7th, and we hope you all come in Willowa, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Kim. So next up is Tidbits, and after that we'll have a short networking break, so if you are intrigued especially by one of our presenters, grab them then. I also want to throw out there that if you are interested in working with youth or connecting with schools, for the last 15 years I've been working very extensively with youth in the Mat-Su Borough, so come grab me during the networking break and maybe I can help you offer things from your fantastic programs for young people.
Hello? This thing working? Hey, everybody. For those of you that don't know me, my name's Dan Ranella. I work with Fish and Wildlife Service, and I'll be moderating the tidbit session. Thanks to all of you for sticking around till the bitter end. There's a lot of you left. I appreciate it. We have nine important, short, 2 to 3 minute updates and announcements, and about a half an hour on the schedule. So we're tight for time, and we'll get rolling here. The first tidbit is from Jeff Falke. He's going to tell us about the next two Alaska Chapter AFS meetings.
Sure. You want the microphone? Or you can go. This is fine. I don't have any slides. So I just wanted to take off my USGS and professor hat and put on my vice president of the Alaska Chapter of American Fisheries Society hat and invite everyone here to our next meeting, our annual meeting, which is going to be held in Fairbanks in March, and that's the 20th through the 24th. And it is going to be a joint meeting with the Alaska Chapter of the American Water Resources Association. So there will be a plethora of diverse and interdisciplinary sessions, including, bring it up here, science communication, shared knowledge, resource security, changing processes, and ecosystem management. So the design is to sort of mix up talks from both societies that are on shared topics. And so that's the abstracts and submittal system just went online this week. And so if you're interested in submitting an abstract or checking out the schedule or symposia, those are posted online on the Alaska AFS website. And then the next year, which is going to be 2018, I think, the AFS meeting is going to be in Anchorage. And so that's going to be a joint meeting with the Western Division. So it'll be a large meeting. And yours truly will be the program chair. So you can, I haven't come up with a theme for the meeting yet, but you can almost guarantee that it will have habitat associated with it. So I invite you to keep that in mind as we go forward throughout the next year. Any questions? Thanks.
Hey, I have one quick question, Jeff. Where is the, do you have a venue yet for the 2018 meeting in Anchorage? The Nina Center? Oh, cool. That's interesting. Thanks, Jeff. The next tidbit is Jimmy Fox. Oh, he's already up there. Take it away.
Hi, folks. Jimmy Fox, and I work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Fairbanks, Alaska. It's great to be down here. This is the second year that I've came down to the meeting here, and I'm really learning so much, and I really just appreciate the opportunity. And what I'd like to share with you just real briefly is a trailer of a film that we made this year up in Fairbanks with a bunch of partners, really drawing awareness to the fact that of all the king salmon that swim in the Yukon River, half of those go into Canada and half stay in Alaska. Of the half that stay in Alaska, the second largest number of return is in the Chena River right in Fairbanks. So the Fairbanks borough right there with the Mat-Su in terms of population density, second, third most dense population in the state of Alaska. We've got this really important river runs right through this urban area. The river is listed on impaired water bodies, so we've got a lot of problems. But this film, Voices of the Chena, it's on YouTube. If you go watch it, what we tried to do is increase awareness, but also congratulate people for what they've been doing to help protect the river and protect the fish. So just want to share that with you, if I can get this all to work. Of course I can't. Oh, yeah, I got to go there. Follow directions. There we go.
Chinook salmon spawning in the Alaska portion of the Yukon drainage, 30% of it occurs in the Chena and Salcha rivers. So this is one of the most important Alaskan stocks. It's also a Chinook salmon stock that travels through an urban area.
The Chena River, the lower section, is one of the few urban waters in Alaska, and it's had issues from pollutants ranging from bacteria to petroleum products to sediment.
Just the aggregate of all the small projects are really, really great in terms of the habitat benefit. And you don't have to be looking at mega projects, but if everybody does a little bit, it would really, really help.
It's kind of rewarding to feel that you are making a difference and that you're going to provide something beautiful to people to look at too.
A healthy river definitely helps the community's bottom line and their economy. This town grew up on this river. This town started on the Chena River. We could not have been here without this kind of river to bring commerce in, to bring people in and out of the community, and to support it with its fish and wildlife.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jimmy. Next up, we have Cindy Gilder, and she's going to tell us about NHD Plus.
Thanks. I just wanted to give everybody a quick update. For those of you who don't know what NHD Plus, it's sort of part of what I think of as a map. And in most of Alaska, every place else in the United States has NHD Plus. In Alaska, we only have it in a small portion of northwest Alaska. The good news is I've been part of a work group where USGS and EPA are funding NHD Plus for Mattsu Valley. They've told us it should be happening at some point in FY17. They're getting working on that. EPA's throwing money, and they're starting on the Kenai River to get that to NHD Plus. Depending on how much it costs will be how far within some of the other priority watersheds they get done. So I just wanted to make sure, hopefully by next time this year, somebody who will be getting a presentation on what that really means.
Thank you, Cindy. Next, Ben Meyer. Where'd you go, Ben? Oh, there he is. And Ben's going to tell us about a new and exciting version of Salmon Life Stages. Yeah, here you go.
Thank you, Dan. I'm a graduate student up at University of Alaska Fairbanks, but several days ago I received an email from Jessica Speed, and she said, "Hey, Ben, we found out about your alter ego as a balloon artist, and we heard that you make salmon balloons, and you've got to come share them with us." So I promise this will be quick, but I need 4 volunteers who can stand right here and be my props for just a second, and you can come to the front of the classroom. Whoever gets here first gets to be my 4 volunteers. Okay, we've got 4. Stop. 4. Thanks. Stop. I can make one for you later, Amy. Eyeballs.
And my point is, less to impress you with my balloon art, but more to say that if you have any kind of art or craft or thing that you're passionate about that relates to your work as a scientist or manager, it's a real powerful way to
Thanks a lot, Ben. That's awesome. And a tough act to follow, but John Harris is here. Where's John? He's going to take it to the next level for Friends of Palmer Hay Flats.
Yeah, I guarantee you this won't be nearly as much fun as imagine listening to public radio during Pledge Week. So you know what you're in for. But you, if it's Friday afternoon on a two-day conference, you must be the hardcore. And I've kind of sensed a I'm with the Alaskans for Palmer Hay Flats, by the way. I'm on the board there, along with my wife, Michelle Davis, who refused to come and do this talk today. So it's going to be bad cop for you, those of you who were here yesterday. This is some video I shot down at the, really the beginning of all that we've been looking at. You look at that drainage that they have on the really great map that Jim put together. Well, this is where a lot of it comes out down here. And I was getting some pictures of the tide guts that are eroding, you know, the hay flats right where it meets salt water at the tide line down there. First, there's a little small gut, and then we go down to a larger one. But it's been caused to some degree by off-road vehicle traffic, you know, other than when it's frozen, when there's 12 inches of frost in the ground down there. It creates collection points which dump into the into the Cook Inlet, and these guts chase these lines back up through here. Now, Doug Hill with ADF&G, they've been down there to put in erosion control as best they can, but really it's an ongoing fight there, and it's one that Alaskans for Palmer Hay Flats really helps with. I think it seems as if the theme these 2 days has been Thursday was the science, and Friday is for action and outreach. And Alaskans for Palmer Hay Flats is the outreach folks. We do it one family at a time during our family fun days. We do it with Wildlife Wednesdays and all kinds of ways. But as you might, yeah, that's Pup, our Malady. He hangs around with us down there. But the point is, you have a chance to turn what is largely an academic exercise in here into action. And how do I do that, you're wondering? Who can tell me who was here yesterday? That's right. You can buy banquet tickets, which I have for sale. Glad you asked. To support these efforts here. I mean, it really, when you consider all the talking that we've done about salmon here, we actually have a chance to actually do something about it. And we do in every way. You saw the viewing tower. What we provide is responsible access to the refuge. Kim showed pictures of people accessing the refuge irresponsibly. But we build trails, we harden trails, we build bridges, viewing towers, a lot of ways east and west and north there to responsibly access this refuge without hurting it. And I hope I can move a few tickets today. Oh, by the way, I do have a program with science teachers at the local high schools here for putting up names of worthy students to be sponsored. You know, if you're not able to make it, it's on the 3rd of December. Everybody's busy. I know it's that time of year. But you can do something by sponsoring a high school student if you can't make it your own self, and I'd appreciate it if you could. I don't know where we are in the thing, but I think we've made it up to the large tide gut here right now. And you can see the jute logs and the silt fences and everything that Doug and Joe and everybody with the state there have attempted to do. And one other thing to notice are the suds in the water there. So somehow, somewhere along the line, Cottonwood Creek has picked up a little bit of pollution, but the hay flats really is the canary in the coal mine for a large part of this drainage we're dealing with here. And if you'd like a chance to do something about it, I'm sitting right over yonder. Thank you.
All right, thank you, John. That's good work. Next, Alex Senta. Hey, Alex. He's going to tell us about the Mattsu Public Works Fish Passage projects.
Yep. Okay, hello, and thank you, everyone, for your presentations. I definitely won't top the balloons. But I'm Alex. I'm with the Public Works for the Mattsu Borough. I'm a project manager, and we build fish passages. We use the federal grants, the state grants, and borough match money to accomplish, I think Jillian said there were 86 projects in the last 15 years. And start with a question. So how many people did it take to do all that work? Does anyone know? Any guesses? I need at least one guess. Okay.
120.
Anyone else? 350. Okay, one more?
9,000.
Okay. Okay, all right. I'm a construction guy. I like numbers. Let's just go through it. But first, I'm just going to start by reading a whole bunch of names. And I think it's about, let me back up a little. 9,000 was the closest, and it was about 28 billion. So I'm just going to start reading names. I'll explain it later, but you'll understand, hopefully. And I can convince you that it actually was almost 28 billion. Okay. Jim Jensen, Paula Kaywood, Jamie Taylor, Holly McRae, Jennifer Ballinger, Ann Dollard, Terry Dolan, Dave James, Jay Hatch, Dwight Johnson, Paul Light, Heather Hansen, Bill Rice, Franklin Deckert, Neil Steichert, Jillian O'Doherty, Ron Bankert, Mark Cowley, Sarah Wilbur, excuse me, Bill Spencer, Lynn Spencer, Tom Gill, Tracy McDaniel, Sheila Armstrong, Bob Y, because no one knows how to say his last name. There's actually a guy named Junker. I don't know if that's his real name, but we call him Junker. Stefan Hinman, Joe Whitaker, Mitch Butler, Cliff Burris, Zach Meehan, Scott Sanderson, Dana Hayek, Heather Anderson, John Buzdor, Leo Gauchenko, Frankie Barker, and the assembly, which was seven people. So that's not 28 billion. So here I'll go into the numbers. Let's see. That was about 43 or 44 people. But if you look at the people who actually contribute to these projects, right, you got the borough match money is basically the entire population of the borough contributes through approval through the assembly. They usually pay about 30 to 40%. There's about 100,000 people there. And then you actually have federal grants, so there's another approximately 324,118,787. So that's still not 28 billion. But if you take and realize that, so for each individual project, it actually takes that many people to contribute. And then we had 86 projects, right? Times that by 86, and you're at 27,882,819,380. So I hope I convinced you today that it takes a lot of people to do the projects, and we really appreciate it. There's a level of effort that is different. Everyone gives a different level of effort and contributes in some way over and over, and it keeps happening. And, you know, we'll keep doing it for you. Just keep it up, and thank you for your work. Oh yeah, and those 43 names I listed were the actual people that I could think of off the top of my head. There's probably a lot more, but just for the one project we did this year. So they're real people, I'm not making them up, and there's a lot of them, so thank you. That's all I have.
All right. Thank you, Alex. That's a lot of people, by the way. Next, Kelly Ingram is going to tell us a little bit about Shore Zone, and I'm hoping you have some visuals.
Yeah. Oh. No, the other way. Oh, sorry. Yeah. I'll just go like. Okay. Thanks. Hey, you guys. Thanks so much for having me the last few days. It's great to be out here for a second year of the symposium with you. I don't get to see you guys, but every symposium, and I don't really work in the MATSU except for to support Jessica and the partnership with the symposium. So it's great to hear the amazing work that you're doing. It's really inspiring. So I know I've been focused on freshwater habitat, but my in my world, I work in the nearshore marine environment and work on a project called Shore Zone. Some of you may have heard of Shore Zone. Hopefully lots of you have heard of Shore Zone. I just wanted to give a little update on some great things that are going on. Yesterday, Stefan said we should brag more, so I'm going to do a little bragging, and I hope you'll cheer me on a little bit for that. So if you don't know about Shore Zone, it's an imagery and mapping program, and we're categorizing the nearshore habitat along Alaska's coastline and better understanding the biological and geological features of our coastline. So this is an image, actually, of the mouth of the Susitna River. So we actually take photos about every 3 seconds. So if you like this photo, you can go online and you can download it for free and look at all this awesome data. And it's all free online at shorezone.org. So please, if you're into this or you want a nice photo for your wall, you can do that too. But what I'm really hoping to celebrate is that we've completed 92% of imagery and mapping for the whole state of Alaska, which is pretty exciting. We've been working on this for 15 years, and while we're not complete yet, and the last 8% is going to be pretty tricky out in the Western Aleutians, we're pretty excited that we've done this, and it's taken a whole slew of partners to make it happen. So I just wanted to give a shout-out to all the partners that have made this work complete. There's over 40 partners in Alaska, over 65 across the Pacific Northwest, doing Shore Zone work from Oregon all the way up to the North Slope. Just want to give a shout-out about that. And also, we have recently updated our protocols and how we're doing a lot of our mapping work, and it's making it a lot more detailed. So we're actually really increasing the knowledge that we have about the nearshore habitat along our coast, being able to understand percent of substrate cover, percent of species assemblages, and doing a lot more understanding of coastal vulnerability and a whole slew of other things. So if you're interested in learning more about how the mapping is changing and being upgraded, just let me know. The protocols are drafted and they're going to be released soon. So just let me know and we can get that information to you. And if you want to learn more about it or if you know people that work in that realm and want to get trained on how to use the Shore Zone data and access it, just let me know. We can get some training for you. On another note, not having to do with this, we have some awesome props. It was great balloons. I'm sure you guys have seen Matt and Sue Salmon on the table where you got your handouts. I think it would be really fun to have a photo shoot. Do you guys think so? I think so, with our props of all these salmon. So if you want to have a photo with Matt and Sue Salmon, and maybe we could borrow the balloons, over the break, maybe go out into the hallway there and we can take some fun, silly photos that we could put online. Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Kelly. Next, Melanie Trost will be telling us about the MATSU Burrows Volunteer Lake Monitoring Program.
Hi, I'm one of two part-time staff in the program, and we work with Frankie Barker, the environmental planner. We have 25 to 30 volunteers any given year monitoring 20 to 25 lakes for baseline water quality. And the two things that I wanted to come up and just talk about real quick was, one, just to let you know we exist if you didn't know, and then also just a few things for trying to dive into just improving how we store and manage, analyze, and share our data, And I know a lot of times with the water quality, it's streams more than lakes, and it can be a little bit different in how you do things. But I thought I would just throw it out there that that's one thing that we're looking at. If anyone has any hot, like, hey, here's how we're doing it, it's working awesome, that we'd love to hear about that. We have things in Excel right now, and that worked, but as we get more and more data, I want to pull it over into a database. I'm not sure exactly what that will look like yet, but one goal is also to make it very shareable with EPA's Storet system. And Laura Shumway at EPA had mentioned, what is it called, the Exchange Network grant, and that is a grant that I found, I got all excited because I thought it's specifically for that type of thing, pulling your data over from whatever format you have it in into a database that is then very usable and automatically will share your data to Storet. And I learned, I thought, oh, the word automatically sounds so beautiful, not to have to go in and do it manually. But unfortunately, being with the borough local government, it's not, we aren't eligible to apply for that grant. It is available to any sort of state, university, or tribal organization. I've started the conversation with our IT and GIS folks, and we might be able to just do it all in-house. It might be just not a problem at all with them. But if it's not doable, I might be looking for, apparently Seldovia Tribe and Chickaloon Village, they are sharing their data with EPA. And I'll be talking to them to find out what they're doing. And if we can't do it in-house, I might be looking for someone who might be interested to partner if what you do jives with what we do and if it would make sense. So I think that is... Oh, and then the other goal that I had was eventually to have an interactive map where folks could just go onto our website, click on a lake and be able to look at graphs and data and photos and just make it really accessible. So thank you.
Thank you, Melanie. The next tidbit is from Jennifer Howell. And Jennifer's going to tell us about Alaska Salmon Fellows.
Hello. So my name is Jen Howell. I work for the Alaska Humanities Forum. And we have recently received funding to launch a brand new program that we're really excited about. It's called the Alaska Salmon Fellows. And the idea behind it is that we don't have a salmon problem. Salmon have a people problem. And throw, as other people have mentioned, all of the information and data and numbers and graphs and statistics doesn't necessarily make change happen. And so our idea that we pitched, and somebody else thought it was a good idea because they gave us money to do it, is that if we were to convene 12 fellows, and those fellows aren't necessarily from academia, but they have to have some kind of connection to salmon. Some, you fish, you're a harvester, you're a policymaker, you're an educator, you are a developer, you, whatever it is that you do, but you have some reason that, clearly you love salmon in some capacity because you're here, so you're our audience, but we need you to help get the word out as well. So these 12 people from lots of different perspectives would come together. There'd be three convenings over the course of the year. Each convening would be about 4 to 5 days long, and the idea is that rather than sitting at around a table and saying, okay, this is my turf or this is my issue and I'm going to defend my issue, first we're going to get to know each other as human beings. And at the Humanities Forum, we do that specifically in our leadership programs through the lens of the humanities. And in fact, Amy O'Connor, who is probably still here in the room someplace, was speaking earlier. She's actually in one of our leadership programs right now and looking at leadership through the lens of the humanities. So that's kind of a cool thing that we do. And the idea is that you get to a place where I can't say, I'm sorry, your idea really sucks, because I'm not going to listen to you, because I've already gotten to know you as a human being, and so now I have to think about what matters to you and include that in my worldview somehow. And then we go into how could we come up with salmon management systems that would work specifically here in Alaska and work better than the systems that we already have. So there's funding that goes with this. Each salmon fellow would get a total stipend of $10,000, and there's also, and all your travel expenses are covered, and then there's funding available for the projects as well. So if you want more information, see me, because I have where to go to get more information about it. and super fast. If you are an informal, or this is a totally different thing, I'm also on the board for the Northwest Aquatic and Marine Educators Association. We're holding a conference in Homer this summer, and we would love to have you get engaged with that organization and have some fun and help us plan a conference that works for Alaskans. So please come see me on either and or both of those things. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Jen. That sounds like an interesting project. That was the last tidbit. We have a little break here, and then someone will be ringing the bell at 3 o'clock to bring us into the last hour of the symposium. Thanks.